Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shoshenworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. In this series, brought to you by Shoshenworks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, we're exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And over the next three episodes, we're investigating the exciting and expanded role that space plays in shaping the future of our planet and the human experience. In this episode, we'll explore the threats, challenges, and opportunities that are necessitating the growth of the space economy. What activated our history of space exploration, and why is it accelerating now? What role does space play in planning for the future of humanity? We're extremely fortunate to be joined today by two of the world's leading futurists in aerospace and the space economy. I couldn't be more pleased to introduce Vikram Shyam as my co-host today. Vic, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Diane. Yeah, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for 15 years, currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. I have a background in propulsion, biomimicry, and foresight, and looking forward to continuing our discussion with Isaac on the implications.
Yeah, super stoked about this conversation. Thanks, Vic. And as Vic mentioned, joining us here today is our special guest, Isaac Arthur, president of the National Space Society, futurist and host of the popular YouTube channel Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur. Welcome, Isaac.
Thanks, Diane. It's really great to be back on, continue our conversation with you and Vic today.
We're thrilled to have you and just fascinated with this discussion. And really, Isaac, I just have to go there. Just to kick off our conversation, great sci-fi usually links us to possible and even plausible futures, right? And an entire segment of sci-fi that many of us have grown up with, which are space-based scenarios, may soon be shifting from the sci-fi genre to the documentary genre. So maybe as we think about futures in this segment, what are some of the more interesting possible future scenarios that could shift from the realm of sci-fi to reality as we move forward on the space exploration path?
Oh my, there's so many of the options there. One of the things we'd like to say on the show is that you have this kind of constant triangle between folks going into STEM, folks going into art and science fiction, that feeding folks who want to go into STEM and the public enthusiasm for them. And I never cease to be amazed by how many folks are interested in that. We just hit 750,000 subscribers on my show over on YouTube, and those are all people who love their science and their science fiction. And one of the things we do on the show is to try to use sci-fi to explain a lot of that science. And so we're looking about what parts of sci-fi are moving into the mainstream, into the documentary, as it were. The cool thing about it is that it's always lots of stuff. Often we find out how wrong we were, like Star Trek, where you got the flip-up phone that they had. Now, of course, we see the smartphone. And in many ways, it's very inspired by that, I would say, the tricorder from Star Trek. But there are always things moving into that realm. And what our goal in the near future is hopefully start moving into that realm where space is no longer just this place of exploration, where space isn't just a place where you put up big telescopes and boundary ropes, where you basically have to have the right stuff, either be a super astronaut in terms of IQ and physical fitness, or you got to have an awful lot of money. We have to have millions of dollars for a flight. We want to get to that point where instead it's millions of people going up on a flight every day. That future could be in the next century or so, but that steps to making that go from sci-fi to reality, those are happening today. I have never seen in my lifetime, and I came after Apollo, so I got to miss that phase. But in the 43 years of my life, I have yet to see this level of enthusiasm as well as actual tangible progress into space as we've had in the last, call it 5 years, but maybe the last 15. But now everyone really is not saying maybe one day, but rather, yes, and win already. Hurry up. I want to see this happen next year. We are there. This time is now, and it's a great time to be involved in space.
Boy, you aren't kidding, but this is a renaissance moment for humanity in our lifetimes. Vic, your thoughts?
Speaking of factors that may invigorate people to look into space exploration and energize us, this is clearly one of those factors that people seem to be very interested. But on the more cynical side, I guess I'm remembering from even 20 plus years ago, we were seeing very similar videos, the grainy footage, and things like that. But now we're seeing a lot more adoption in the media, in the established news organizations and such. So any thoughts that you have on either the veracity of what we're finding, the plausibility, and then what might the implications be in terms of where we start to research and where society moves from this?
I'll start by saying two aspects of this. This is the curiosity in UFOs, the greater discussion of this in a public theater, in a official public theater too, is actually entirely positive. And I say that in the context of someone who is very skeptical. I'm almost as skeptical as you can get about aliens. I tend to be assuming we're not going to encounter another intelligent species anywhere in our own supercluster, or maybe our Hubble value, not just our galaxy or local neighborhood. I don't mind being proved wrong on that, but that's been my current reading. At the same time, I really firmly believe that more open discussion of this is always a good idea. I'm not expecting these phenomena to turn out to be aliens. I mean, it's just as likely it could be another country's secret weapons, our own secret weapons from one branch hiding from another, or it could be creatures from a different multiverse popping through. These are just as likely scenarios based on what little, i.e. very minimal evidence we have in terms of what it would mean. But I'm glad that people are talking about it seriously, because one of the things that I always disliked growing up was how much of academia ran away from anything with the word alien in it right from the get-go. And so that was understandable because they didn't want to wreck their reputation, but at the same time, it could be at times almost a little bit cowardly and also not really very scientific. You got a phenomenon that's in doubt. You don't start off by saying, well, it definitely isn't X. And I don't think any of these things happen to be alien myself, but it's wrong. I have reasons why we go through and step-by-step discuss why it probably isn't them, as well as how maybe it could be them. We don't take it for a given, and we certainly, in this key one, do not ridicule people for trying to do that. I don't agree with A.V. Loeb about Oumuamua, for instance, the asteroid, but I'm very glad some of his respectability actually came out and said, well, I think it could be an alien probe, because very few people say, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He clearly does. He could be wrong. Everyone could be wrong. Einstein could be wrong. But he had the courage to step up and say, here's what I think. And that's something we also hear a lot of these folks who are coming out. I think they're being honest in the witness testimony. I'm sure some are lying. But for the most part, these are people who have very little motivation to and very little instability to be dishonest actors. And so I choose to assume they're being honest, but an honest account is, well, science doesn't believe honest accounts in themselves. We believe in evidence. We believe in thorough testing. And we know that you can be the most honest person in the world and still say something that is wrong. And so we don't want to be hesitant to explore these topics and just honestly, and not be without ridicule and without any sense that we have to just accept that it's true. We also keep in mind that it could end up being true. And there are many ways we can get into space. We might second help to push us into space faster. Maybe it'd be that gold mine on an asteroid. Maybe it's space-based solar power. Maybe it's getting a signal from SETI or from something like Tab of the Star, where it's not a signal, but real noise, and saying, we need to build a gigantic, enormous telescope, and we need it next year. And that's just the boom that starts the whole other space industry rolling. So if nothing else, there could be advantages to us from alien contact that way.
It seems like just saying, I don't know, might be the right way to go and then investigate. But people seem to be reluctant. We tend to be polarized and fall on one side or the other and then try to make arguments from there.
Yeah, and I think so. That's the biggest trap to resist, is you don't have to be polarized on it. I am an arch skeptic about aliens, but I've cheerfully talked to folks who are very much on the aliens are among us side of things, and I find them to be, by and large, rational, friendly people like most people. And if you treat their views with respect, you don't have to agree with them. You can tell them your own. They'll treat you with respect and listen. And sometimes they change minds that way.
Yeah, I think that's so important, right? As we, and maybe one of the more important shifts as we move from sci-fi to reality, right, is just getting the mindset shift in that surrounds the conversation, so that this is not, to your point, Isaac, exploring these possibilities, right, is not met with kind of a stigma, right? It is pure scientific exploration, right? And we don't know what possibilities exist, but there is a method and a means to explore what space may hold and what those futures may be for us. And I've seen so many incredible videos, Isaac, on your site. You put some really incredible content out there. And I've seen your very thoughtful exploration of the fact that we might not only be talking about space exploration here, but also maybe some time dimensions. And you recently also published what I thought was a fascinating video that explored the potential concept of off-Earth life in the form of ammonia-based life forms. So we can start to shift our frames, right? As we look into the great beyond, we can start to shift these frames. So you published this conversation about the consideration of ammonia-based life forms, which could significantly increase the range of potential discovery well beyond what you described as the Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold environments for carbon-based chemistry. So can you maybe share with our listeners a little bit of that concept and that exploration?
I would say that was actually one of the fun episodes to do, that we get to do these kind of, you could debate how likely ammonia as a potential solvent like water is to be a source for life. And I would say that a good amount of skepticism is very healthy there. But at the same time, there's these interesting parallels. And we have only this one example of just Earth to look at. So we have to be careful ruling things out. But it's fun in the sense that it just gives people a chance to kind of spread their wings out a little bit and think about the alternatives involved there. And that, in this case, included a couple of biologists who helped give ideas or even edit on that script, which I was grateful for because biochemistry has never been my specialty. So I think what was most fun about that was just seeing how different the sort of water would have to be to allow ammonia to be the dominant thing available as opposed to water, or if you could have both at once in some situation where life would spawn in the ammonia rather than the water. And you see this in a lot of different cases too. So say, well, could you have life that was based off of quicksilver or mercury? You say, well, honestly, not very likely. You could probably engineer something that way, but wherever you're going to find a place where mercury is the most abundant liquid around, but ammonia is so incredibly common. Like methane and like water, they are stupidly abundant in space. Not quite hydrogen helium levels of abundancy, but they're up there as those top molecules that we find floating around. But we find them floating around further from stars. But there may be some other stars where they are more able to survive in areas that we get sunlight. So say, would you have an ammonia-based ecosystem that was only on very cold planets and thus probably very limited on what could be produced? Though that could be where they pop up, since we assume photosynthesis was not how life started here on Earth. Or could you actually have a planet that was, I want to say warm, but not sub-Antarctic, on which there was actually a decent amount of sunlight coming in, and yet in which you could still have ammonia being around? And he thought, well, actually, around red dwarfs, that's reasonably possible, more stable red dwarfs. Well, what are most stars in this galaxy and in other galaxies as well? Well, they're red dwarfs. That was the big surprise of astronomy in the last few decades, was just how many of them were smaller than our own sun. And these are probably all going to have planets. So in that regard, the entire conversation around exoplanets these days is surprise and speculation about all these strange things we would not expect. With red dwarfs, are they all going to be tidally locked or are they not, because the atmosphere acts as a lubricant? All these little factors right now will probably define that, you know, water on a planet like Earth really still is the almost guaranteed best path to life. But even just getting to explore them on the 1% chance they might turn out to be true is still a lot of fun. And they may turn out to be really vital to our actual ability to find life in the universe and find places to settle too. So maybe ammonia is the dominant life form in the galaxy or the universe, and we just haven't seen it yet. But one of those topics which is so much fun to explore.
Just an interesting concept. And there seem to be other, like, to the silicon-based life hypotheses as well. But it seems like many times when we talk about where we might find life, we also need to go back and look at abiogenesis, the whole sequence of events that leads to, say, intelligent life, which is what a lot of people get really jazzed up about. And it seems like that sequence of events, from the conditions on early Earth, the prokaryotes to eukaryotes, and what's the role that the moon played, and how peculiar our solar system is in terms of the ordering of planets and such. So it seems like there's a lot of other factors that may as well.
And I think the example we like to use on the show, of course, these are called filters. Robin Hanson, if I'm supposed to come up with that, he's the same gentleman who came with Grabby Aliens. But the idea of filters is, of course, that maybe your planet doesn't have this one factor that it needs. Maybe the sun's the right thing. These changing variables that might prevent life from emerging, or may just make it much harder for it to do so, because it's a bit of a game of time on all these things. Planets lose their atmospheres with time, for instance, so you have a window in which life could arise. And if you were to stack those up and say they were all just coin flip odds, just a 50-50 chance of having a big moon like that, which, of course, we know it's lower than that, you say, well, that should be life all over the place. And you say, well, if there's 50 factors, what is 2 to the 50th power? It's like, wow, that's pretty big. What is that? That's gigantic. That is like less than likely to happen in the entire universe on every star that's existed. And so that changes your perspective on just how likely life can be when you're starting to take the attitude as, well, maybe this one does and this one does, but it loads up. And that is something we explored in one of our Fermi Paradox episodes that was on the longer side, because we walked through them all. But there is also those things that we just don't know what the odds are. It's that Drake's equation level of uncertainty. And Drake's equation has some systemic issues with it that people can discuss. But the biggest one is just that we put all this big block of how likely life is to happen in one variable. And it can trick people because, like, well, you got six variables there. They're all one-tenth like these first three, how many planets form or et cetera. Then surely this one variable must be one-tenth too, when it might be one in a bajillion. And I think that is something we're seeing with a lot of these factors for life, but it is that question is, again, we don't know, because just looking at Earth, we still don't know where life originated here on Earth. We have theories, but it's so hard to even say. We saw the faint young sun paradox to deal with. We have phosphorus scarcity issues to come up with. We have bombardment issues. There are so many little factors that we don't understand yet. And so we can't rule out something like panspermia, that life might have popped up in the comets and seeded during the heavy bombardment. Not terribly likely, but still on the list of plausible scientific answers. Is it tidal pools or deep thermal vents or highly phosphorus concentrated pools deep on the land, or so many other factors, including just the one, what if alien life had come out by one day and popped out for a quick visit, cleaned up all their garbage, but flushed the toilet on the way out? And not a very auspicious beginning for our world, but a possibility.
Yeah, but I guess I'm going to put aside my skepticism. We do take the notion of, let's say, that there are some alien species, or we take these UFO claims seriously. Like you're saying, we need to investigate them to find out what are the implications. In the previous podcast, we talked about things like what might the implications be for global cooperation. And it doesn't just have to be aliens. It could be an asteroid coming towards us. It could be some kind of other anomaly that we haven't prepared for. So any thoughts on what might actually happen in terms of civilization? Would we come together as a community? Would there be more division? We talked about even things like trolling on social media, AI bots. What's the future?
I think the answer in terms of like what would happen if tomorrow we had something from space, like an asteroid coming towards us or aliens coming towards us, is on the one hand, we would be forced to a certain amount of unification, but that's not always a good thing. And how you do that, that's very important too. You could take the COVID issues or some of the economic crisis the whole globe has had together as examples of times we've worked together and not always done the best job. So I think that would obviously, to trivialize it, say that would probably be true of an asteroid coming towards us. Would aliens drive us together? Well, it depends on how they're coming. If there's no armada coming, then the answer might seem like yes, but it might be every man for himself. And I don't have to, we're being chased by a wolf. Well, I don't need to run faster than the wolf. I just need to run faster than you. And there's that element with us. And we have our great moments, our noble moments. And they are gratefully when they actually appear, because they help to kind of overshadow our less admirable moments. But I think that any of those projects has the option, any of those events where you've got an alien signal or just proof that alien life is out there, on the one hand, it is going to change us forever. On the other hand, I don't ever see it being one of those situations where suddenly there's a riot. It's in the streets. We have had polling for years that showed most people believe in alien life these days. And I think that it would be the big news item for a week or a month, and then normality would return. It has to. Humans are wired to handle crisis that way. We have to be able to move on, and so we wouldn't that too. But you know, you would never completely move on from it. It becomes a new, huge paradigm of your civilization, and then the challenge is, did we make it a positive paradigm or a negative one? And with our background in history, I'd say probably a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. So it's the nature of opportunity from crisis.
No, I love this conversation. And if we think about space futures. And I know you have both given a lot of thought to space futures. With or without the discovery of any level of biosignatures in space, Isaac, you and your SF really exciting and risky new horizons that we might unlock for humanity as we explore the mysteries and the abundance of space. Mobile cities, artificial planets, lunar mining, and more. The content that you and the conversation that you publish is just fascinating. If we step back and maybe just, Isaac, if you could share your ideal vision for what a space-enabled future looks like for society and industry for the next several decades, what does that look like?
I think I see it as one where we have, hopefully, a lot of people from many different backgrounds. And I mean this in the sense of not just folks who want to run a telescope, not just folks who want to build that for space mine or that for space farm. Many different backgrounds start taking a look, an active, strong look at how that rolls into a future in space. And we had the example of NASA, for instance. They are principally an exploration-based organization, so they have that bias to be into everything. They are amazing in what they do, but space is huge. It is huge. It is so big. And here on Earth, we have over 200 nations just on this one little pale blue dot, each of whom has so many different departments, Department of Commerce, Department of Transportation, defense, etc. Space eventually needs to have these. We don't need to jump to have them too quickly. They'll occur by mitosis, I think. But we need to start looking towards what infrastructure do we really need to develop that future in space. And with the emphasis, that future in space does not belong to any one person. It is not one ideal thing. And one of the things I've always loved the most about space development and things like space habitats, the giant O'Neill cylinders, is those are inherently spaceships. So one of those things can always move if it doesn't like its neighbors. In a future of so much space and so much options, we must keep in mind that it is the promise to everybody, including those who we don't necessarily like. But we might say, yeah, we'd like you so much, your space to go do your thing on your own, go away. And that is the future that this holds for us. As an option is that space is huge. And so it's got infinite options and possibilities for everybody, not for any one country, one field of study, or one industry, or one group of people.
I love that. I love that. As an innovator at heart, it just, to me, unlocks, and to your point, an infinite realm of possibilities that we can explore together. So that's my key takeaway from this discussion. Vic, as we wrap up the conversation about space futures, what are some of your key thoughts from this conversation?
Took away a couple of things. One, I think, was the exploring all the possibilities part of it. Don't dismiss things out of hand. So I like that. So while maintaining skepticism, let's explore these things. And with foresight, I think that's a good lesson to learn, right? The more possibilities we consider, the more resilient our approaches are. And the other one is the opportunities beyond scientific exploration. So you're talking about society in space. So as we're thinking about whether it's Moon or Mars, we need to be thinking about the other social infrastructure that we need to maybe consult or bring along for the ride. And think about like departments you mentioned, Mike. So yeah, that's what I took away. So
yeah, absolutely. Great points. Love this. And Isaac, again, thank you for sharing your fascinating insights about space-enabled futures and what the opportunities that might present for humanity. And for our listeners, if you've just joined us for this episode, please be sure to catch up on a previous episode with Isaac Arthur, where we introduce some of the challenges that are igniting and accelerating the flight to space, and how space may offer some strategies to help safeguard our future. Please also join us for our next episode with Isaac, where we continue the conversation about space, introducing opportunities to design for greater resilience and how we might better prepare for the future that space offers us. So do join us for the next Ecosystemic Futures podcast. In this series brought to you by Shoshimarks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, in which we'll continue to explore projects and topics with world-class experts who are leading in the arenas of foresight, development, and design for greater ecosystemic resilience. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And as always, you can learn more at shoshimarks.com. Thank you, everyone.